Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to bridging the gap between adventure and adventurer by helping people select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The president is not on the ballot this year. No North Carolina senators are running. But aside from races in various congressional districts and general assembly seats, there are six items that have attracted a lot of attention. Those are the six proposed amendments to the state constitution. We're being asked to vote for or against amendments that protect hunting and fishing rights, a proposal to limit the state income tax rate, an amendment to provide additional rights for crime victims, and one that would require voter ID at the polls. But the two getting the most attention would shift power from the governor's office to the legislature, changing the process for filling judicial vacancies and making changes to the state board that enforces ethics and elections law. Both have drawn criticism from all five living former governors who are encouraging a no vote. Polls show that most voters don't know much about these amendments, so this hour we go in depth to examine exactly what these would do if approved. Colin Campbell is editor of NC Insider, reporting on state government for the Raleigh News and Observer. He joins us initially by phone. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. How close to you are you to the studio now? Just checking in.
I am about two doors down from the entrance to the studio. If you hear the water in the background, that's
okay.
That's right. American Tobacco waterfall.
All right. Well, run. He, along with our other guests, join us, or eventually will join us, from the studios of WUNC in Durham, and they are Brent Woodcock, special counsel at the North Carolina General Assembly. He is here to speak in favor of the amendments. Good morning to you.
Morning.
And Jerry Cohen, former director of legislative drafting and special counsel at the General Assembly. He is here to explain the opposition. Thank you for being here as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So, Colin, let me start with you, if you're still in earshot. Why did the legislature feel the need to propose and put on the ballot these six amendments to a state constitution?
Well, ostensibly, the stated reason is that I think they're necessary and important additions and changes to the Constitution. You can read between the lines and know that, obviously this is an important election year, and these are things that at least a few of them, particularly voter ID, the right to hunt and fish, income tax cap, all things that would motivate conservative voters to go to the polls in a year that perhaps Republican turnout might not be as high as it has been in past years. And then, of course, there's the two that limit powers of the governor, and of course that's a sort of swipe at Governor Roy Cooper, a Democrat from the Republican legislature, in trying to limit some of his powers with approval from the voters. So that's sort of the main reasons for doing these and getting six on the ballot in one year.
Is it any surprise in a divided nation in which we live that Republicans are encouraging voters to vote for all six amendments while Democrats are encouraging a no vote on all six amendments? I mean, is there more to this than merely politics?
I think the messaging is a big part of this for the politics of it, because there's not great labeling on the ballot. There's not numbers. There's not short titles to help people identify which is which. So I think the Democratic Party was sort of forced into, in order to properly oppose the two that really limit the governor's power, they were having to go against all six different amendments.
Okay. So Governor Roy Cooper sued several times over the amendment that would take away power from the governor's office and transfer it to the legislature, and courts declined to hear an appeal from the NAACP in their suit to strike the amendment creating voter ID requirements and one that would lower the state's maximum possible income tax. Meanwhile, in his suit, Governor Cooper asserted that lawmakers had used misleading language in how they were presenting these proposals on the ballot. Former Congressman Robin Hayes, who is now the chair of the state Republican Party, said after those court decisions that Republicans want to allow, quote, all voters a say in regarding their state constitution, and it's disappointing that the governor believes citizens are unable to understand the amendments for themselves. Voters are often confused in the voting booth when they come across language used to describe various bond proposals, for instance. So, Jerry Cohen, is this language any more obtuse than bond issues that they may have run across in the past? Is it deliberately deceptive language in your mind?
Well, the legislature was forced by the state Supreme Courts to rewrite the ballot language for two of them. And I think it's certainly either not misleading in a couple of cases now or less misleading. And I think that you mentioned the state Supreme Court. I think my top line looking at this is the message from the General Assembly overall is, and I'll explain this later in the Q&A, you can win the governorship or the Supreme Court, but we'll make it worthless to you.
Brent, do you want to respond to that?
Well, you know, the first thing I want to say is it's a pleasure to share this panel with Colin and Jerry. Colin runs one of the most respected news organizations in state government. Jerry's forgotten more about state laws than I'll ever know. I literally could not do my job unless he came before me. But we're going to have some disagreements today, but I have a high amount of respect for these two gentlemen. As far as what the legislature has done, I think that they've put these things on the ballot because many of them are very popular. They're politicians. They want to come back to Raleigh. They want to continue to get reelected. And if they don't put these things on the ballot that the voters are asking for, they may very well not come back to Raleigh.
Are the voters asking for this? Are the which of these six amendments did the voters ask for?
I think when you're looking at the right to hunt and fish, that's something that's been talked about for many years in North Carolina. We haven't put it on the ballot. Voter ID has been very popular. It's been an ongoing conversation since before 2013 when the legislature passed a law to try to do that. Now they're going to give the voters the opportunity to add it into the state constitution. Victims' rights are very, very popular. And yes, there's a struggle of separation of powers, the balance between the executive branch, the judicial branch, and the legislative branch. And you would not be surprised to see that the legislative branch is asserting its authority.
So, Colin, would you agree with that from a 30,000-foot nonpartisan view? Would you say that the voters have been encouraging legislators to put these initiatives on the ballot, these constitutional amendments?
Well, it depends on the initiative. I think some of them are things that may prove popular at the polls. I don't know that there's necessarily a lot of, you know, write-in or call-in campaigns to get this on the ballot this year. But certainly the polls do show support for some of them, at least based on the ballot language. I think there was a poll done by Spectrum News recently where they basically just read the ballot question to folks. And as Brent said, the victims' rights one is very popular. I think the most popular with about 70% support. Voter ID, hunting and fishing also getting fairly popular support. The ones that I think voters don't understand and are perhaps less likely to support are the two that take some of the governor's powers and shift them towards the legislature. I think at least one of those did not have majority support when they pulled it.
Which is where the living governors got involved in this, former and otherwise, Democrat Jim Hunt, Republican Jim Martin, Democrat Mike Easley and Bev Perdue, and Republican Pat McCrory. They oppose several of these amendments. Colin, which ones?
They oppose the two, like I said, the ones that take the governor's powers. One involves the state elections board that regulates elections and ethics, currently appointed by the governor with recommendations from both political parties. A 9-member board now would switch to an 8-member board with the members recommended by the legislative leaders of both parties. So still a bipartisan board, just a slightly different format and puts the legislature more in control of who serves on that board. The second is involving judicial vacancies. The current system allows the governor pretty much carte blanche to pick whoever he wants to fill any openings on the courts, both at the local and the state level. This would switch that to a sort of multi-tiered system. The bulk of it, the decision-making process, goes to legislators. They would narrow the field of candidates, give some finalists to the governor, then the governor would select the final person.
So, Brent Woodcox, I know that you favor these six amendments. At least you're here to speak in favor of them. What message does it send to you and to members of the legislature that all of the living governors, including two Republicans, oppose these amendments?
Well, former chief executives favor executive power, news at 11. You know, I'm not exactly surprised that chief executives see the value of this system that they've used to put people on the courts. In fact, Governor Perdue appointed 4 members of her administration the last day that she was in office. So I don't know that she necessarily has the moral authority on this question.
This is Jerry. I wanted to add something here. Mm-hmm. I think that it's important to remember that in the case of judicial vacancies in the Board of Elections, that the amendments basically reverse state Supreme Court opinions. Our state Supreme Court is majority Democratic currently. And on the voter ID thing, if you look nationally, where this has come up a couple of times, where state Supreme Courts have interpreted the state constitution to say voter ID isn't permitted, such as Missouri and Arkansas, this will basically forbid our state Supreme Court from reviewing the voter ID against our state constitution. As far as the hunting and fishing and victims' rights, everything in those two amendments could have been done by statute. There was no need from a standpoint of state law to do this with a state constitutional amendment. We have a 1995 constitutional amendment that said it could be implemented by law, by act of the legislature. So I think I don't have any really particular opposition to those two, but I think they were not needed.
Although I understand, although you oppose the amendments that the governors oppose, you voted in early voting, if I'm not mistaken, against all six. Jerry, why?
I did that. I actually voted by mail, but yes, I voted against all six. One of the issues, in the past, this is the third highest number of amendments that have ever been on the ballot. In 1914, there were 10, all of which were defeated. In 1970, there were 7. The legislature here stepped out and passed a bill forbidding them to be numbered or lettered on the ballot. When we've had a large number of amendments before, they've always been numbered. So it's made it more difficult to distinguish between the amendments. So I think that I'm not sure how much we really want to talk about process, but I disliked the entire process that was involved here and voted against them finally when I went into the voting booth because I intensely disliked the process by which almost all of this was done, except the process that the Victims' Rights Amendment was.
So several times in this conversation, people have mentioned the fact that these are not numbered on the ballot, and I have a sample ballot in my hand, and in fact, that is the case. It just says constitutional amendment, and then some language, constitutional amendment, and then some language, and it goes on and on. Is there a reason, Jerry, that these were not numbered? Is it so that people cannot say vote against Amendment 7, for instance?
Well, I mean, I can't tell you the reason, but I can tell you the legislature the same week as it was passing 4 or 5 of the 6 passed a bill specifically prohibiting them from being numbered, despite our tradition in North Carolina to always number them when there's been a large number. So I can't tell you why that was
Brent Wilcox, can you tell me why?
I mean, I think that what legislators wanted was for people to engage with the substance of the amendments. And the best way to do that was to look at the short description and decide based on that, not just a vote no on 7 or vote yes on 3. Unfortunately, our political debate has corroded to the point that it's just vote no on all or vote yes on all. And nobody's actually talking about the substance. So I'm glad that this conversation and others like it are taking place because they do matter. What is being asked of the voters matters.
Well, let's go through these then. Let's talk about the language. Let's begin with I'm just going to go in the order that these will appear on the ballot. They're not numbered, but we're going to go in this order. The first deals with the right to hunt and fish and reads, quote, constitutional amendment protecting the right of the people to hunt, fish, and harvest wildlife, end quote. Colin, do hunters and fishers fear that these pastimes are under attack, or is this because these rights have been considered so basic that they simply want them enshrined forever in the Constitution?
I think it's ultimately the latter. In the debate leading up to putting this on the ballot, no one really was able to come up with a particular situation where there were rights that could be stripped away by legislation or by any sort of near-term future push, but there was a feeling that these rights are so important that they deserve mention in the Constitution. So this doesn't really change anything in terms of actual process and procedure and what you can and can't do in terms of hunting and fishing, but a lot of people do feel pretty strongly that this should be in the Constitution.
We're going to take a break. We'll talk a little bit more about Amendment, the first, well, not Amendment 1, the Hunting and Fishing Amendment. We'll talk a little bit more of that and get into all 6 of these amendments, the language, what it may mean, and why they were worded that way, and what the opposition and the proponents have to say about all of this in just a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that believe a car is used for more than just getting from place to place. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the constitutional amendments that will be appearing on the ballot when you go to vote this time around. We're joined by Colin Campbell, who's editor of NC Insider, a publication of the Raleigh News and Observer. Brent Wilcox is a special counsel to the North Carolina General Assembly. He's here to speak in favor of the amendments. And Jerry Cohen is a former director of legislative drafting and former special counsel for the General Assembly. who is here to talk in opposition to these amendments. On our website, we're asking listeners if they feel informed enough to vote on these amendments. Most are evenly split, I'm told. But you can take the poll at wfae.org/Charlotte Talks. Surveys indicate that most people know very little about these, which is why we're doing this morning. As I went to early voting, somebody handed me a leaflet urging me to vote no on all the amendments, and their reason for rejecting the fishing amendment is as follows. It says, it is supported by the corporate gun lobby and lets the legislature decide how you hunt and fish. And the News and Observer reports that Jill Fritz, Director for Wildlife Protection at the Humane Society of the United States, says supporters around the country are pushing the idea that without these amendments, citizens or interest groups will try to prevent sportsmen from being able to hunt and fish in the future. She calls these amendments a solution in search of a problem. Jerry Cohen, what's your response to that?
I think the greatest threat to hunting and fishing in North Carolina is urbanization. And I don't think much can be done about that. I think that maybe the solution is, I don't buy the first argument that it's some gun lobby business, but I think that it is a solution in search of a problem. The House passed version of the bill preserved municipal ordinances forbidding discharging firearms in the city limits, but in conference committee, the Senate insisted on taking that out. So, you know, that may not be legal anymore under this constitutional amendment, but I don't think that the amendment is the greatest threat to anything.
So, Brent, are either of these arguments valid, or is this a solution in search of a problem? Is there any evidence that the right to hunt or fish is under attack in North Carolina?
You know, there's a traditional view of government and constitutions themselves that says that certain rights are inalienable. They come from God, not from the government. And they should be recognized in constitutions because of that fact. And that this is among those that a lot of people feel very strongly about, that it precipitates the government that comes before that. As far as what out-of-state trial lawyers will make a buck trying to challenge in North Carolina, there seems to be no limit to that. So maybe there's no current threat, but the idea that there never would be, I think, is misguided.
One legislator, Darren Jackson, who's a Democrat from Wake County, who grew up hunting, he says he believes this amendment is a throwaway, one that acts as a distraction from what he views as more dangerous amendments on the ballot. I know, Brent, that you disagree with that, so why is he wrong?
Well, it's just amazing to me that we have the leader of a political party that is not even trying to win voters that hunt or fish in North Carolina. This is North Carolina, right? I mean, this is a state that values outdoors activities, that values those things. And traditionally, there have been many people in the state who have done that. And it's amazing to me that we have a political party that's ostracizing those people.
Are these a throwaway or a distraction, Jerry? This amendment?
Brent on this. I think that that's the example of the politicizing it right there. I think that there is zero need for this. All of this could be done by statute. There's no need to amend our state constitution. And in fact, the Senate insisted on taking out a provision in the House bill to preserve municipal ordinance on discharging firearms in the city limits. And it preserves traditional means of hunting and fishing without really defining that. Is that bows and arrows? Mm-hmm. Yes. And that is a traditional means of hunting and fishing. So I think it is a solution in search of a problem. And if the purpose of the Republicans is to try to paint the Democrats into the corner on this, I think it's failed in terms of the election strategy. The Democrats didn't bite on that.
So in a column you wrote in the News and Observer, Colin, you boiled down all of these amendments to a basic question for each. But in this case, you posed the question, no one's trying to restrict your ability to hunt and fish, but would you like to see the Constitution explicitly spell out those rights anyway? That sounds benign to me. Do we know whether most voters, most hunters and fishers want this?
I think you'll see a lot of them voting in favor of it. I certainly have gotten some emails from readers in response to that column who I think suggest that they believe that their rights may be under attack. They may not necessarily have a whole lot of basis for that, but they certainly have that concern. And I think that plays into this, but I do think this is something that's likely to pass. And even a number of Democrats from more rural districts have come out in favor of this and voted for it in the legislature. So while the overall party strategy is nix all six, and including this one, individual Democrats have voiced support for this.
So let's go to the next one. Here here's the wording for the next amendment. Constitutional amendment to strengthen protections for victims of crime, to establish certain absolute basic rights for victims, and to ensure the enforcement of these rights. Jerry, what do you believe this amendment would do if passed?
Well, I think that we had a 1995 constitutional amendment on victims' rights mm-hmm. that enacted a number of rights and said it could be further implemented by law. I think everything in this amendment could be done by statute. It could have been in effect on July 1st, and putting in a referendum perhaps could be viewed as delaying these victims' rights by 6 months. I don't think it was needed. I don't think it's particularly harmful.
Okay. Colin, this amendment would require victims to be notified about all proceedings in their case. Doesn't that already happen?
You get it on a certain level. This would sort of expand the different stages of the proceedings where you would get a notification and be allowed to be heard in court. So the example that I was given by the supporters of this was that right now, if you are a victim of a crime, you probably will almost certainly get the opportunity to speak at sentencing, but will you get an opportunity to speak at the bond hearing to determine whether the suspect goes free on bail? That's something that would be explicitly spelled out in this. This also expands the people who are covered under the victim's rights protection. So yeah. Property crimes currently not covered on there. So if someone breaks into your house, breaks into your car, you may not be treated as a victim under the current statute. This would expand that to folks in those situations, as well as violent misdemeanors that are not domestic violence oriented. So certainly more people getting this procedure from prosecutor's office. I've talked to some prosecutor's offices where they already do this, but this would sort of standardize this yeah. across the state.
So, Brent, we just heard Jerry say that opposition believes that this will result in delays of justice. What he didn't say was some believe this will do that at a hefty cost to taxpayers. And there were fears of a slowdown happening in other states where this has been adopted. And that has not turned out to be the case. Are you confident the same would be true here should this amendment pass?
Well, I mean, you don't know exactly what the cost will be to the court system, but at a certain gut level, you have to decide whether or not we want victims to be more involved in the process, regardless of what that means for how the court operates on a day-to-day basis. Is it getting more justice? And we're in the middle of a national moment that I think is very positive, Me Too and all this, where we're starting to say, you know, we want to hear from victims and we want to hear their stories and we want to make sure that we have a more just society where people are called to account when they do things wrong, that when they break the law. And I think that this Victims' Rights Amendment is a part of that, too.
So is opposition to this purely based on delay of justice and the costs associated with greater victims' rights, or are there other reasons that you would encourage, Jerry, people to vote no on this, other than the fact that you've said it could have been accomplished through a statute?
I think it's not necessary. If somebody feels like they should amend the Constitution to put these in, that's fine. Amending the Constitution makes it harder to change things in the future. You can view that positively or negatively.
Brent, respond to that.
I think that the reason people are against this amendment is because they want to nix all six, and it's about their opposition to the rest of the amendments. It's not really about this one. They're not really that concerned with this. It's basically benign, as Jerry said, but the campaign to nix all six requires that you nix this one.
Okay. And again, as I said before, I think the legislation to ban numbering them was sort of like a legislative own goal. I think the campaign would have been vote no on 3 through 6 instead of nix all six.
Okay. So the next amendment reads, quote, constitutional amendment to reduce the income tax rate in North Carolina to a maximum allowable rate of 7%. That's all it says. And Colin, you point out that the current rate is 5.499% with a constitutional cap of 10%. This would lower the cap. Why is this controversial?
Well, the concern, and I think one thing to I should stress at the get-go on this is some people may be reading this wrong and thinking they're voting to cut their own taxes,
yes.
which is not exactly what's happening here because, like as you mentioned, the tax rate is currently lower. So the concern is essentially whether you're tying the hands of future legislators to deal with any problems that come up. The idea being that if we have a recession followed by a natural disaster and we need to raise money for schools, would there be a situation where it would be necessary necessary for the tax rate to go up above 7%, either for personal income tax rate or the corporate income tax rate, which is significantly lower than 7% currently. So that's been the big concern about this one, but this is one where I do think people are going to tend to vote for it, whether because they're going to see this on the ballot and they're going to think that they're voting for a tax cut.
Well, what they're going to see is constitutional amendment to reduce the income tax. That's all they're going to see. So is that, Jerry, what you fear, that voters will not read beyond that and automatically vote yes?
Well, the first four words are reduce the income tax rate. I think that's four, which, of course, it doesn't do. The later part of it is the correct part. It reduces the maximum rate. I think that, you know, when the Republicans took control of the legislature in the 2011 session, they, as certainly they had power to do, changed the income tax structure to de-emphasize income tax, and that's certainly a good policy choice. I think what I see here as they have three-fifths in each house and can put a constitutional amendment on the ballot, and some have viewed this as sort of locking in those policy changes by making it harder for the legislature to change it in the future. If the Republicans, for instance, had a 65-55 margin in the House after this election, they could no longer put that on the ballot. So I think friends of mine have said this is an attempt to lock in their gains. I mean, there's nothing unconstitutional about locking in their gains, but it does reduce flexibility of the legislature in the future.
Okay. Brent, let's talk a little bit about this, because lawmakers have been cutting taxes in North Carolina since the Republicans took over the General Assembly, and they want to keep taxes low. That's one of their talking points and one of their ideological strong points, I suppose. But does putting the cap at 7% put a potential stranglehold on state government in times of need? We just went through two powerful hurricanes, and although there's money in the rainy day fund to support that, what if we get 5 and 6 hurricanes? Does this strangle their ability to fund things?
Well, there are a number of taxes and fees that are raised in North Carolina. It's not just the income tax. There's also the sales tax. And then you have to also keep in mind that you could raise everybody up to 7% and you bring in billions of dollars. I mean, we're not talking about a little bit of money. Every 0.25% raises about $500 million for the state. So you could immediately raise the income tax even to 7%. And this is not unprecedented. When it first went into the Constitution, it was at 6%. And within the last decade, we've had income tax rates that have been above 7%.
And during this, Jerry, and during the Depression is when it was increased from 6 to 10%, when there was critical fiscal needs in the state and when the state took over local programs.
Well, the Depression is relevant because we've had about the same tax system since then. And we're not any longer an agrarian economy or even a manufacturing economy. We're a service-based economy, but we don't tax those things on a sales tax basis. One of the things that the legislature has tried to move from is emphasizing the income tax to diversifying the sales tax to try to bring in revenue. And that actually brings in revenue quicker, because you get sales tax on a monthly basis, whereas income tax is paid annually.
But some say
actually, it's quarterly estimated, and it would come out every 3 months, you'd start paying more.
Some say we already underfund schools, and this would cause a permanent underfunding. Do you agree with that, Jerry? I mean, because the legislature can always move money around. I mean, if schools feel underfunded and there's a need for more money, they could rob Peter to pay Paul, no matter what the tax rate is, right?
I don't agree with that argument.
Okay. Given that the corporate tax rate here is 3% and it's scheduled to fall to 2.5% in January, and the personal tax rate is already 4.99. What is the upside of this amendment, Brent?
The upside is that the people get to decide how high their tax rate is going to be. I mean, if they want to allow the legislature more authority to raise their taxes, they can vote no on this amendment and just leave it at 10%. I mean, if people are interested in trying to make sure that their income tax rate never gets above 7% again, then they should vote for the amendment.
Do you see an upside, Jerry?
This is Jerry. I think that the voters can decide every 2 years what they want their tax rates to be by electing legislators who agree with that position. I don't think we need to amend the Constitution to do that. I think it unnecessarily locks things in. We have elections every 2 years to elect people who will decide what our laws are.
And what are you hearing, Colin, from readers at the NNO or just in general from voters? What are you hearing from them?
Well, I think this is another one that's sort of gotten into the partisan split over this, is that you people who are in the Nixall 6 camp are opposed to this for a lot of the reasons that, that Jerry pointed out. Republicans, not surprisingly, supportive of anything that keeps taxes low. But there are some concerns I've heard from folks at the local level, which has been interesting, that they're concerned that if you limit changes in the income tax rate, that forces the revenue to be raised perhaps at the local level through higher property taxes or through local sales taxes. That sort of thing. So that's, I guess, one possible thing that people are concerned about.
So let's go to something that is very controversial, has been for years. Quote, constitutional amendment to require voters to provide photo identification before voting in person. That is the wording on the ballot, and this is where things to start to get a little tense, because the legislature has made several attempts at this, only to have them struck down by the courts. Colin, you say the question is, should a photo ID be required to vote? And if so, are you okay with letting the legislature decide on which types of ID would be accepted? And without putting words in your mouth, I would guess you're saying that because we don't know exactly what the legislature will do with the power this amendment would grant if passed. That's what the question really is, correct?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's carte blanche.
Yeah, there will be a legislative session at the end of November, should this pass, and they will come out with a bill that explains exactly what types of photo ID would be allowed. But right now, no one's really come out and said, you know, is this going to require the real ID driver's license that takes a lot of extra steps to get, or are we talking just a regular driver's license, regular ID card issued by the DMV, or you can bring in anything with a photo on it? Could you bring your Costco card in? We don't actually know the answer to that yet, and so that's something that I think voters have to consider as they go to the polls.
And we have about a minute left in this segment. We'll talk more about this on the other side of the break, but Jerry, this is one of several of these amendments put on the ballot without what you call implementing legislation having already been passed. It's unusual for that to be the case, but is it unprecedented?
Well, since 1982, there was a shift after three amendments were defeated in 1982. Since then, up to this year, 13 of the 14 constitutional amendments had implementing legislation passed before the referendum to allow the voters to have a better understanding. Yes, that legislation can be changed, of what might happen. This year, none of the six have that. So it is a deviation substantially from the norm.
And we have 30 seconds. Why is it being handled this way, in your opinion?
I honestly don't know. Brent has had some ideas that it's not needed, or that it can be, if it's enacted, it can be changed. But our constitutional norm for 40 years has been to let voters know more detail before the referendum.
Let me take a break. We'll come back and talk more about this and the final two amendments on the ballot requiring your vote in just a second. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Colin Campbell is here, editor of the NC Insider, a publication of the Raleigh News and Observer. Brent Woodcox, special counsel for the General Assembly. He supports the amendments to the Constitution. Jerry Cohen, former special counsel of the General Assembly, is here to speak in opposition. They're all joining us from the studios of WUNC in Durham. Did the legislature, Brent, make a mistake by not putting the exact definition of photo ID on the ballot? In terms of what they plan to do if we say yes to this, why should we vote on something so fuzzy?
I think it was wise, actually, for them to resist the temptation to put exactly what types of IDs would be allowed.
But why? We don't know what we're voting for. They could come up with anything after we say yes.
But that's part of the conversation that we're having right now, is how restrictive do we want it to be? How forgiving do we want it
well,
to
don't
be?
You
and
think
also,
there'll be exceptions. Don't you think we ought to know? We don't go to the polling places and vote for candidate X versus candidate Y. We know who they are. Why go to the voting booth and say yes to something that we don't know precisely what it's going to do when we say yes to it?
Yeah, well, this is the problem with implementing legislation, is you don't know who's going to represent you 2 years from now. As Jerry said, every 2 years we have an election for the General Assembly, and we can overthrow the government if that's what we choose to do. And so they can change the legislation. They can make it more types of IDs. They can restrict the number of IDs. But I expect that this will change based on what the experience is with elections and how easy we can make it for people
this
to vote.
This is Jerry. I think the real issue here has nothing to do with photo ID. It has to do with the state Supreme Court. In Arkansas and Missouri, their courts struck down photo ID on the basis it violated the state constitution's right to vote. Those two states put voter ID amendment on the ballot and passed it. I think all this amendment has to do is overturning the Fourth Circuit opinion striking down voter ID. by insulating it from state Supreme Court review. We don't know the types of IZs that will be permitted, and I think that's a definite problem.
So we're not ruled by judges in this state. We're ruled by the people. The people make these decisions.
The people
that's
elect
why
the
they
judges.
Ought to be able to decide.
The people elect the judges.
Okay. So
statewide.
So you're saying, Jerry, that this is a reaction to previous attempts at voter ID being struck down by the courts. So put it in the Constitution so the courts can't have any power over it. That's what you're saying.
The state. I think it's an attempt to have to withdraw from the state Democratic majority, and I know it's partisan now, state Supreme Court the power to review this under the state constitution in the hopes that the federal courts are changing with U.S. Supreme Court nominations.
So there's great support for voter ID around the country. I think 70% of people polled support voter ID. A state audit, however, found in 2016 that 0.1% of ballots cast were by ineligible voters, because one of the arguments in favor of voter ID is to stamp out voter fraud, of which there is literally none. But the bottom line, Colin, is if we vote yes on this amendment without knowing exactly how the legislature will decide to word what kinds of ID are acceptable at the polls, are we handing over the keys to the kingdom here?
I guess it ultimately depends if you trust your legislators to do something that's reasonable or not. And I think that's what it's going to come down to for a lot of folks who may support voter ID. I do think that perhaps we get opened up, and the lawyers in the room may know more about this than me, to lawsuits in the future. If the voters explicitly put voter ID in the Constitution, then that's probably lawsuit proof. But the legislation after the fact could be challenged as unconstitutional if it seems to be too restrictive on which types of IDs can be used.
And I think it's not a coincidence that the legislative session that's likely to enact the implementing legislation is scheduled for 1 hour after the election results are certified.
So they've already written the language, what you're saying.
I don't allege that, but I can't imagine that there aren't drafts out there somewhere.
Okay. The next amendment is it's about filling judicial vacancies, and it reads as follows. This is the longest one. Quote, constitutional amendment to change the process for filling judicial vacancies that occur between judicial elections from a process in which the governor has sole appointment power to a process in which the people of the state nominate individuals to fill vacancies by way of a commission comprised of appointees made by the judicial executive and legislative branches charged with making recommendations to the legislature as to which nominees are deemed qualified. Then the legislature will recommend at least two nominees to the governor via legislative action not subject to gubernatorial veto, and the governor will appoint judges from among those nominees. That's one sentence, a long, very difficult sentence, but Colin, you boiled it down to this. The real question, you say, is, should the legislature have a bigger role in picking judges to fill vacancies on the bench? The current system gives the power to the governor alone. But the wording of this amendment says that the people of the state will nominate individuals. So how does that work with the way this is worded?
Yeah, so this is a kind of complicated process, and if you're trying to parse that sentence, you maybe have your head spinning while sitting there at the polling place. The way this starts out is, so instead of the governor picking somebody, there's a sort of an application process. So I could nominate Jerry to be a judge, or he could nominate himself if he wanted. That application would then go to an appointed commission, including folks that were picked by the judicial branch, legislative branch, and governor's office, so sort of a mix of people. They evaluate your qualifications, make sure you're actually qualified to be a judge, you're not too old, you have a law license, that sort of thing, and then they take their findings, send that to the legislature. The legislature will then narrow down the field of applicants to at least a couple that they will then forward to the governor. The governor will make the final appointment. So ultimately, I think the upshot of this is you could have a situation where if the Republicans are in charge of the legislature and they want exclusively registered Republican judges, they may put a slate of only Republicans in towards the governor, and then he picks among those, whereas now you have a system where the governor is doing it all by himself, and the criticism of that system has been that the governors, both currently and in the past, have used that power to nominate their friends, their colleagues, members of their administration as they're about to leave office, and then that doesn't have enough checks and balances.
So, Jerry, this is one of the amendments that all of the living governors are opposed to for obvious reasons, because it takes away executive power, but it still leaves the governor in the loop. Is it simply because they have no discretion? They'll not be able to veto the legislators' nominees, and they'll have to pick one of them. And even if they don't like any of them, they have to pick one of them?
Well, I think Colin's analysis is correct, but I have to start off by saying is I don't like the current system at all, but I think this makes it worse. I'd favor a system where for vacancies the governor nominated and the Senate confirmed. I think that would be a model we've seen that would be good. I think this system is fraught with more conflict. I think it takes us back to pre-1865 when the legislature appointed all the judges. I think that's what this basically is. I would suggest we go back and come up with a different proposal.
Is that the motivation, Brent, to limit the power of the governor and put it all in the hands of the legislature?
I think you're just looking at a system where the governor can literally appoint any person that he wants. I mean, family member, a member of their administration, a donor to their campaign, anyone. There's no check or balance whatsoever. Is this a better system? I think a number of states have started to talk about judicial merit and whether or not this can help bring better people onto the bench, and hopefully it will. I think what this conversation is getting bogged down with is the current political environment, that we have a Democratic governor and a Republican legislature. We won't always have that. We will have divided government. We might have a Senate that's Republican, a Democratic House. They'll have to come together and decide on people. Hopefully they'll choose the most qualified people to put forward.
Hmm. Some of the opposition says this would give power to the legislature to appoint political cronies who will rule in favor of corporate polluters and other special interests. It sounds exactly like what you just said, Jerry, about what people criticize the governors for doing right now.
Well, I think that under this proposal, the legislature could do almost exactly what it suggests the governor has done.
Yeah.
So I don't think that's a significant change. There was a giant poster up early in the process talking about people who had been defeated and then appointed by the governor to fill later vacancies. Well, the first one listed was Bill Bobbitt, who lost a Democratic primary. He didn't lose an election, and he turned out to be, when appointed by Governor Hodges in 54, one of the most eminent jurists in North Carolina history. Yet he was up on a poster showing why this constitutional amendment should be adopted. I think totally misguided.
So some, Colin, have argued that this will lead to court packing, in which lawmakers will add more judges to the state Supreme Court in order to get more conservative judges on the bench because it's a Republican legislature at the moment. How is that intent gleaned from the wording of this amendment?
You know, it takes a little bit of a stretch on that, and this is something we have to go back to 2016 on this issue. The legislature had a chance to add seats because they legally have the right to the Supreme Court in the end of 2016, back when Pat McCrory was the Republican governor, and he would have been able to fill those seats. They ultimately decided not to do that. That was something Democrats were very worried they were going to do. They found other ways to take away the governor's power as Roy Cooper got ready to come in. So there's still concerns about that. This scenario, hypothetically, and I should stress that Republicans have been asked about whether they want to do this. They say there's been no discussions about adding seats to the Supreme Court and trying to get Republican judges on.
But again, with this amendment, there's no language to spell out how how the legislature or the committee of the legislature would evaluate nominees' qualifications, no language to describe the process that legislators would take to pass on those nominees to the governor. That would be decided after the voters have their say on this. Is this an oversight, something that's deemed unnecessary? Is it a way to pull a fast one on voters?
I think, again, it's one of those sort of fill-in-the-blanks later thing, in part because the Constitution could get bogged down, I guess, if you had too much language about that at the legislative process level. It does have to be a bill through this, so that would have to be voted on by both chambers of the legislature in order to go to the governor. But as far as exactly who gets to make the selections, is it just the leader of the Senate and the leader of the House picking their own preferred names and putting them before the full chambers, or is there some sort of committee process and some other vetting? Like you said, that's yet to be spelled out and would be in whatever bill comes out in November if this passes.
Is it a surprise that a Koch brothers-backed group, Americans for Prosperity, has come out against this Republican effort? Why are they opposed to this?
You know, this was, I think, one of the more surprising developments of this election season, because that's a group that's fairly in lockstep with the Republicans in the legislature on a lot of things, and this was sort of an unusual one. Their concern was interesting in that they felt like it took away voters' power because under this amendment, somebody who's appointed to fill a vacancy could be in office longer before they come up for election than under the current system, where an appointee by the governor would more quickly come up for an election to fill the rest of the term. They were concerned that took power away from the voters. So that was sort of the crux of their opposition.
But the governor is the only statewide elected official, I think, well, they're probably Secretary of Education and things like that, but he's the only one elected statewide. Why shouldn't the governor have the power to do this, to act in the name of the people if he's gotten the most votes?
Brent, you want to take that?
Sure. I mean, I think that the people have a better chance of influencing their legislators. And it's harder to get 170 people in the General Assembly to commit to some political conspiracy to put people on the court based on their political views or what they'll do for the legislature than it is for just one person, the governor, to do that. So I think that it's wise, and it actually gives more power to the people to have both the judicial, legislative, and executive branch all involved in these choices.
This is Jerry. I think reject this amendment and come back with something different for 2 years from now. Have the governor appoint subject to Senate confirmation. I think that this is an unwise proposal. And we say influence 170 people, but that's not what happens. You just have to influence the majority of the legislature.
So we have 3 minutes.
Republican or Democratic caucus.
3 minutes left. So let's get to the very last amendment that we haven't talked about. This constitutional amendment to, quote, establish an 8-member bipartisan board of ethics and elections enforcement in the Constitution to administer ethics and elections law. Colin, you say that it boils down to this. Should legislative leaders from both parties select the people who oversee elections and ethics issues, and should that board have an even number of members? How does it work now?
So currently, this is a system that's come out of a number of lawsuits and back and forth between the governor and the legislature since Roy Cooper became governor. But we currently now have a system that has 4 Democrats, 4 Republicans, and one member who's not affiliated with either the Republican or Democratic Party. That can be an independent, unaffiliated voter or a third-party member. And that person was nominated by the other board members with the selection at the final by the governor. So we would go from a 9-member to an 8-member board with potential for ties in that, and that's the big concern folks
right.
have.
Right, and the ninth member, it currently, correct me if I'm wrong, is unaffiliated. They're a tiebreaker. Is that correct?
Yes, that's okay. True. It sort of allows things to get done when the parties deadlock.
So all of the living governors oppose this one. What are your positions on this? Brent, I'll begin with you.
I think that this is an idea whose time has come. I mean, right now we have people on the far right and the far left, every time they lose an election, try to cast doubt on the integrity of the entire system. To have a board that requires bipartisan votes, Democrats and Republicans coming together to make the rules, rather than have one party or the other make all the rules for elections, instills confidence in the outcomes and will help voters have confidence in our system.
Jerry.
That's whataboutism. I don't know of any case where Democrats have alleged that there was some process problem with the entire election.
The 2016 election? Seems familiar.
In North Carolina? No, not at all. I don't think the Democrats said there was some problem with the election system. In any case, I think this boils down to one thing. I grew up in a state where there wasn't even number of Democrats and Republicans on the elections board, and it worked because there was bipartisan cooperation. That does not exist here. I think to pass a constitutional amendment on the ballot entirely on the votes of one party with the other party opposing it and call it bipartisan is basically trickery. So I think and my libertarian friends say, bipartisan, where are we? Why isn't it called multipartisan? So
okay.
You can offend as many people as you can while you drag this along.
I have one more question, but I don't have time to ask it because you don't have time to answer it, so I'll leave it at that. Jerry Cohen is the former director of legislative drafting, and a former special counsel to the North Carolina General Assembly. Brent Woodcox is the special counsel to the North Carolina General Assembly. And Colin Campbell is editor of NC Insider, a publication of the Raleigh News and Observer. They all joined us from the studios at WUNC in Durham. Thank you all for the hour. Charlotte Talks is sponsored by Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to helping customers select vehicles that fit one's lifestyle. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.